Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Slate's XX GabFest is sponsored by Bowl & Branch, making luxury betting affordable and convenient to order from home. Right now, get $50 off a set of sheets plus free shipping when you go to bowlandbranch.com and use the promo code XX. That's B-O-L-L and branch.com and the promo code XX.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX GabFest for Thursday, July 9th, the Beazle Better Have My Money edition. Oh my God. All right. I'm Hannah Rosen, a writer for Slate and The Atlantic. I'm joined in the New York studios by June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah.
Okay, let's jump into our three topics. First, what does it mean to be officially asexual? Second, Rihanna's new video, Bitch Better Have My Money, and also the general use of bitch. How do you say this? Prefatory bitch? The general prefatory bitch? Like if I say bitches, how do you use bitches like that?
Prefatory bitch would be bitch better have my money, y'all.
Okay. Bitch better, how about this? Bitch better have my money and other prefatory uses of
Well, I think it's prefatory
bitch.
If it comes first. It's not prefatory. It's not just prefatory. It's prefatory if it begins this. If it begins the phrase.
We are the only people analyzing the grammar. Just putting that out there.
All right. We'll do it even like in more detail. Okay. Third, the first installment in our movie club, which we're very excited about, the 1939 movie The Women, based on the play by Claire Booth Luce, which actually almost uses the word bitch, but does not. Okay. Let's talk about our first topic, asexual. I have to say I'm kind of afraid of this topic because I understand, but I'm not completely sure I understand, and there are so many ways to go wrong with this. But we'll start with a brief definition. Asexual, defined as a lack of sexual attraction to any gender. It's different from aromantic because a lot of people who have written about this and adopt the label say they want to be in relationships and they want to be intimate, but they are somewhat indifferent to sex. We chose this because in Modern Love this weekend, a writer named Kim Kaletsky says, 3.5 months into a relationship, I spent 10 days in Chicago's suburbs with her. We did nothing more physically intimate than holding hands, kissing, and taking a nap together. And I returned home with an intense sense of relief. This was the relationship I wanted. She says, not the kind that treated sex as necessary or the indicator of a healthy relationship, but the opposite, a relationship in which sex wasn't compulsory. All right, before we get deep into the debate, can you guys help me define, like, do you feel like you have a clear understanding what it is that people mean when they identify as asexual?
I mean, I guess there's a spectrum, an asexual identification spectrum. And I guess the, you know, we've read about things like graysexual and what was it, demisexual and asexual.
And
I guess
and gray asexual too.
Can you define gray asexual?
Gray sexual.
Fuck no, no, no. Wait. Gray asexual means sort of asexual.
It's not, first of all, it's not gray asexual. It's gray sexual.
I think. No, I'm reading here like this whole testimony somebody wrote, which I sent to all my friends because I felt like so out of it when I read it. But it said she describes her husband as on the asexual spectrum, but more like somewhere between pansexual and gray asexual. And I was trying to fix an image of her husband, and I just like I ended up with Peter Pan. Like I just couldn't fix it, you know.
Well, so maybe those are just ways to term the same thing slightly differently, right? But gray sexual or gray asexual means someone. Help me out, June.
Well, I guess an asexual is someone who has no interest in sex, just not interested in physical intimacy. And then gray or demi or semi or anywhere on the spectrum would be different gradations of that. Some interest, a little more interest, you know, leading all the way to no interest whatsoever.
But isn't that just like humans at different points in their lives?
Well, I think that is why people are saying that this is a different identity rather than just like low libido. That for them, this is just a state. This, they're not interested. It doesn't even occur to them. It never occurs to them. This is people who are completely asexual. They're not interested. They don't have those feelings. And it's not just a matter of right now I'm not into it. It's just not part of their makeup.
But then people who are graysexual or demisexual, that's where it becomes confusing
right.
to me because right. you're saying, okay, I identify with this characteristic, but, you know, sometimes I have sex and sometimes I like having sex. And I understand that sexuality and always exists on a spectrum and
right.
desire exists on a spectrum and all that. But that to me is where the semiotics of it become confusing. And
yeah.
and just because the words that people use to describe themselves mean so much to them, especially in this arena. And that's why it can get it's kind of complicated to people who, you know, don't have personal understanding of this.
I think that's right. And I think we always are, we always understand that everything's on a spectrum and we always, at the same time, are drawn to things that are black or white.
Mm-hmm. And well, that's what was curious to me about the various testimonies. Okay, it would have helped me to know the ages of the people because I guess I would think it was more unusual if you were like 22 and kind of deep in your dating moment and you weren't feeling it, right? And then it would feel more like an identity. Like, it's something that it seems to me like experience would have to show you. Like, how would you know that you were this identity asexual as opposed to just not feeling it at that moment in your life?
Or afraid in some way of what your sexual identity might be.
I mean, Dan Savage is really hard on that question. And as you noted, June, when you read about this topic, you notice that there are many trigger warnings before people link to Dan Savage because he's hard on the asexuals who write him because he, like, there was one letter where someone who described themselves as asexual, or I'm not sure if they used that term, maybe they did, as saying, you know, is it okay for me to be in a relationship with a normal sexual? And he was like, no, like, why would you torture the normal sexual like that? That's not fair. Like, they want you to be into it, you know, so he gets into that kind of like Dan Savageness.
Because it's very important for him for couples to be like matched up libido wise. Like, it's one of his big things is that if you are in a couple where one person wants a lot of sex, the other person does not, you're never going to be sexually fulfilled. I mean, which does seem to be a basic truth. At the same time, does also, you know, it's always hard to give out. You cannot be with this. You should not, you know, nobody likes to hear that kind of instruction, even if you sort of pause for a moment. It makes perfect sense.
But the way, like his tone, I think the reason his tone sets off the asexual crowd because it seems to imply that it's a dysfunction that is not, in fact, on the healthy continuum, but that it is, in fact, a lack of something, which is what I think people who define themselves as asexual are fighting against. This is not a lack of something normal. This is just like another way of being.
Yeah. I mean, I think any time that you compare a group of people to normal, that is never going to feel right or pleasant.
Yeah. I think some of the fascination that everyone has with the topic of asexuality, like it's, you know, probably about 1% of the population, but it gets a fair amount of ink spilled on it, is that the rest of us are like, I don't know, how do I measure up against these people? How sexual am I? You
right.
know, there's just this constant measuring that human beings have when it comes to sexuality. And this is just like, you can't help doing that.
One of the stories that we read mentioned that comments on stories about asexuals are often the most nasty of all comments areas.
Mm.
And that one person said, this is the ultimate freakiness. People can understand kinks. People can understand strange desires, but not having desires, that's something that really freaks people out. What?
Yeah, I think this is like the last frontier of sex positivity is to create a space for people to not express their desire to not have desire, which is sort of fascinating.
Yeah.
Wow. So I'm going to read. It is really interesting. I'm going to read this letter. I think this came to Dan Savage. How can I tell if I'm asexual? Is it a legit orientation or am I just a seething ball of neuroses? This self-description. Sex does nothing for me. I can't orgasm even when I attempt masturbation. So my husband doesn't go there. That's fine by me. I hate my people parts. I find them icky. Is that normal?
So that doesn't sound like asexuality to me. That sounds like a description of something different. I might be treading into like Dan Savage trigger warning territory here. But I think actively hating your sexuality is very different from just disinterest, right?
That sounds like more disgust or dysmorphia.
Yeah.
That's different. What the asexual testimonials are trying to express is indifference. It's like they are not indifferent to intimacy. They like intimacy. They like relationships. They're just kind of indifferent to sex. Like it's like a low libido, right?
See, the area where I feel most sympathy or most, I don't know, connection or recognition with asexuals is that whole feeling of, let's just use this term low libido, which I think they would disagree with, but whatever. We're not going to argue about that right now. We're just going to say, okay, that's what it is. But the way our society is organized is all about having that one partner that you have sex with, and that partner becomes, you know, your... The couple is everything in America. That's who you socialize with. That's the peak. You know, you live with that person. That's the person that when something special happens, you're with them. You don't invite your best friend to go to the White House. You invite your lover, you know. And so if you're not going to have a lover, I can see the challenge of like finding that person, finding that thing that our society is organized around. You know, the peak of our relationship goals are one person. And when you have one person, typically it's a sexual relationship. And so finding a fulfilling relationship that's romantic and intimate, but never going to be sexual, I can see that that would be a major challenge in terms of management or location identification. I can really see the difficulty of that.
Well, what's the difference between that relationship and a best friendship? Like, what makes that romantic if it's not sexual?
It's because when you have a best friend, you don't do that special thing with them. Like, again,
this sounds like Sesame Street.
I know. When that special thing in this case is not sex, I'm not talking about having orgasms with them. I'm talking about, like, you know, just there's the most precious time, right? When something
Stop. Like precious time and special thing.
No, but like, don't you guys know at all what I'm talking about?
Yeah, sure, intimacy.
But it isn't. Yeah, but it isn't just like sex intimacy. It's not just physical intimacy. I can't say it without saying special times or best moments, but like
deep connection.
No, it's not even that. It's like there's always, like, I guess I am really relating to this because I do feel often denied by this. Like there are people, like I'm going to go really weird here. Like Hannah, if I had that connection with David, if David and I just got on so fabulously, we just like fulfilled each other in our conversation. Let me just be clear. Like we just could not get enough of each other's conversation. But I might feel jealous of you because as his partner, as his wife, you're always going to have, and here I'm getting stuck again, like the best times, the special times.
You, right. You mean like I'm the anointed one. I see what you mean. It's like I have the title, right? Well, that's what kind of, I think, unsettled me about this asexual identity is they were describing a kind of relationship that I would actually like to have with different people, like that I, you know, stopped just short of because it's oddly threatening. So the idea that you like put a label on it and call it asexual and we are a couple now, but we're an asexual couple. And I'm like, oh, that really means I can never have like a good male friend because then we would be, what would be the difference between me and this male friend who I am not sleeping with and this asexual couple who is intimate but not sleeping together?
Well, it's different because you are not asexual. Right. And so you have a partner, you have a person who's your person who in a bunch of different ways. Right. And so you can have those close friendships because you're, I don't know, I can't finish that sentence.
About me and a female friend? Because a lot of this seems to be gender indeterminate or like a lot, at least the asexual testimonies that we read, it could be like one time a man and one time. It's gender fluidity seemed to somehow, I don't know if that's generally true, but it seemed to go with asexuality.
But you can't have an asexual relationship because you're not asexual.
Yeah.
Oh. Damn it.
I mean, well, but so the labels, I still am so interested in the labels and the way everyone needs to have some kind of sexual identity that they can like fly the banner under, which is so interesting in this era where we all acknowledge the spectrum in all different ways. But also you have to like name your little corner of it, that you're like a cis, hetero, romantic, gray sexual or whatever it is, that there has to be some way to explain yourself to other people is fascinating.
You need at least four adjectives or you're no one.
Do you think this is totally condescending and completely patronizing? But is this just something you do in your 20s because you haven't had the wide range of experience? Like, I know because I'm older that, like, there have been phases of my life when I felt like this and other phases when I felt like that and other phases when I'm attracted to this person or that person. Like, it's not, I don't know, you know, I guess I could come up with a definition, but a lot of this just seems like a moment. That's totally patronizing and wrong. Right?
I mean, I guess just if you have never had this feeling, then you are an asexual. I suppose that the conclusion of that way of thinking is that, well, at some point you might have that feeling and then would you stop being an asexual?
Right.
I mean,
right.
There's a corollary to me around, like, a lot of the time young gay people, they haven't had sex. They're not officially gay, I guess, but they know that they're gay. And so, you know, for asexuals, just because they've not had sexual feeling yet, they probably have a pretty clear sense that they're never going to have it.
Yeah. And you know what? I think I'm totally wrong, because if you've gone through your teenage years when there's just like high hormones everywhere and everyone's kind of horny and you just couldn't get on that wavelength at all, you probably would feel different. Like that's a moment when you would think, oh, there's some category that I belong to that most of the people I know don't belong to.
Yeah. And I do think it must be very lonely. I mean, everybody is going, especially when you're young, everybody's going so crazy and doing such crazy things. I mean, sex makes people do insane things.
And it's also the plot to every movie, yeah, every TV show. I mean, it's just like, not to be all, you know, Bill O'Reilly, but we live in a very sexualized culture. And so I wonder if part of it is a response to that, like saying, okay, like, I'm kind of alarmed by what I'm seeing. And I hope I'm not also being condescending here, but I'm kind of alarmed by what I'm seeing. This isn't how I see myself. Maybe I'm asexual because I'm not this version of sexuality that I'm seeing out there.
Yeah, I understand both sides. I understand someone like Dan Savage saying, listen, maybe you just haven't had good sex yet. Maybe you need to relax more. Maybe you need to find a partner who's more understanding, who's more in tune with you. I can see why somebody like that would say that. That makes sense in a very kind of logical way. I also, you know, I'm not going to challenge people's views that, I'm sorry, I just don't have that feeling. It's not just that I've not met the right person. I just don't feel that way. So I can see both sides.
Yeah. And I have to say the Kim Kolesky column in Modern Love was quite good. I mean, it really gave you a sense of what this was like developmentally. Like, to answer my condescension, she does write about her teenage years, I'm just remembering. And she says, like, they were, you know, they'd have sex class. All her friends would call her and say, oh, I just slept with this person, or that person is hot. And she just sat around and she says, all of this talk of sex, she's talking about her high school years, had me forever ready for my own sexual desire to kick in. Yet in a journal entry from the previous year, I had written, I don't seem to be attracted to anyone and I don't understand why. I remember lying on the floor in my parents' living room, listening to the Smiths and thinking something was horribly wrong with me, which is very like, you know, that sounds like a gay story, like right, a coming out story. Like, there, you just recognize that something about your sexuality is alienating and marks you as different.
Right. And one of the things that I think is changing as we do become a more sexual society, or a society that's more open about sexuality, is realizing that everybody comes out. You know, heterosexual people come out too. You know, they realize where their desires are. We've so far, it's been a coming out as typically meant something that minorities do. But I think, you know, everybody has their awakening and realizes who it is that they're drawn to. And we're becoming less and less of a view that there's a normal one and the rest. And maybe asexual is another kind of normal too.
That's so interesting. So one thing I think about, maybe we'll end with this, is that if you, down the road, like the way these things often start is they start on the coast, or they start in San Francisco or New York or on college campuses, and then they become mainstreamed. Do you guys think all of this will become mainstreamed? Like, I'm pretty much guessing that, like, maybe a working class person in Ohio has not absorbed the term asexual yet. So does it all sort of filter out there? That doesn't mean that everybody starts talking about pansexual, a gray sexual, and defining themselves in like really minute ways. But do the concepts become more acceptable the way gay does?
I mean, I think if people are feeling it themselves and they don't know, you know, they just feel different. And then if they hear this term, they'll recognize it. I don't know if we'll all be describing it or if there'll be a million stories on Slate about asexuals one Friday afternoon. But I definitely feel like for those people who are really struggling and not feeling that the way they feel is what all their friends are feeling, if the growing awareness of it, it'll filter down to them. And then no matter, you know, what their background, it will feel good for them to have to know what they are.
I think we're in like a weird moment where increased freedom and acceptance is bumping up against deeply ingrained judgment that human beings maybe hold just like as part of their DNA. And so the reason people want to talk about it so much is that it is happening in this weird petri dish of a moment where that's all swirling around. And maybe that'll dissipate as everything becomes even more acceptable, or maybe it won't. Maybe, you know, humans are always going to want to put a label on who other people want to sleep with and why, and who knows.
Right. Okay. Next, let's talk about Bitch and Rihanna. But first, we would like to thank our sponsor. Now I put a little space between Bitch and our sponsor. Our sponsor.
Bitch,
is not
listen
a bitch.
To our sponsor.
Bitch. Well, the problem is that our sponsor has lots of B's, Bull and Branch. And so Bitch and Bull and Branch kind of go together. So I don't want people to remember that together.
It's Bull and Branch, Bitch.
No, Bitch, it's Bull and Branch. That's how we have to say it from now on. Anyway, Bull and Branch is a sheets company. Now, I'm going to read exactly the ad copy for the first part because it relates so well to our previous topic. We all spend a third of our life in bed, sleeping on sheets, but not necessarily having sex on sheets, perhaps only cuddling on sheets. I just made that whole part up.
Oh my God. They're getting their money's worth.
Anyway, so the thing I actually really love about this company is its ethos is very slate pitch. There's all this stuff about that Bull and Branch has gotten right. Like, for example, thread count. Do you know that thread count is a total marketing myth? It means absolutely nothing.
What?
I found that sort of exactly. I found that shocking. Nor does Egyptian cotton. That's a completely meaningless made-up term. The cotton doesn't even come from Egypt. They have all this great material that the company puts out. So it's really cool. Anyway, so Bull and Branch, it's just soft organic cotton. It doesn't shrink. It's got a fair trade label. So there were no little underage hands sewing those sheets. And here's the other thing. Most sheets are marked up 800%. The reason they are not is because there's no department store markup. You just buy them straight from Bull and Branch. Okay, here's the other awesome thing. Three living U.S. presidents sleep on Bull and Branch. Now, the question is, which ones? Now, there aren't that many living presidents.
I'm sure Jimmy Carter, he's got to be one.
That's true. He rolls around in his Bull and Branch. So does Christina Aguilera, Ashley
Wait,
Judd.
Is she a living president?
Yes.
President of our hearts and minds.
President of American
Feminist
Idol.
America. Damn it. Alicia Silverstone, Alyssa Milano. Oh, my God. And one day you. Okay. Anyway, they only sell online at bullandbranch.com. That's spelled B-O-L-L and B-R-A-N-C-H. Bull and Branch. You can try them risk-free for 30 nights, but only if you levitate over the sheets. Just kidding. Oh, boy. Okay, $50 off a set of sheets plus free shipping if you go to bollandbranch.com, B-O-L-L and branch.com, using the promo code XX. Okay, let's move on to our next topic, which is Rihanna's new video, Bitch Better Have My Money. I don't know. I sound just like Rihanna when I say that phrase. So much so that I'm going to say it again. Bitch better have my money. How's that? Does that sound
just like her? So Beijing.
Just like her. Exactly. And for this topic, we're going to be joined by Slate's Katie Waldman, who wrote a fabulous story about the use of the prefatory bitch, most prominently by Rihanna, but also by other people. Hi, Katie.
Hello.
Let's start with the feminist interpretation of the video, which is that it's both totally feminist and totally anti-feminist at the same time, right?
Should we describe it first?
Yes, let's describe it. You do that,
oh, God.
Noreen,
okay.
Because you're the bitch.
So the movie opens with a blonde, tan, white woman walking out of a fancy apartment.
It's a video. You just think it's a movie because it affected you so deeply.
It's a movie. I mean, it's a short,
short
movie.
Film. It's a short
okay, the
film.
Short film.
This is one of like two movies I've watched in the last. So the music video starts with Rihanna walking into this apartment as this woman is walking out.
Or they move into an elevator. They
move into an elevator. And basically she kidnaps this woman and holds her for ransom with along with her, like, cool girl gang. They're in a convertible. They're in a pool. They are
on a yacht.
They're on a yacht. They're smoking out of a bong. They're, like, eventually the kidnapped woman starts, like, kind of having fun with it. She's getting into it. They're doing her hair. They're being pursued by police. And so the bitch in question in the movie turns video, music video, turns out to be Rihanna's accountant, who is married to, or, you know, this woman is his girlfriend. And the end of the video, someone gets killed and it's not the woman. It's probably the accountant. And you see Rihanna sort of blood spattered like a Tarantino hero.
And along the way, she does, the blonde woman, does get pretty mangled. She's hung upside down from a hook. She's hit on the head with a bottle. She is tortured quite a bit.
And naked quite a bit. She's naked. There's like an S&M element to the movie.
Yeah.
Film.
And
video. Music video.
Masterpiece.
Masterpiece. Oeuvre. Yes. So, okay, let's start with what is obviously anti-feminist about it. Who wants to take that one?
Well, there is excessive triggers for violence against women and torture.
I mean, and anti-sisterhood. It's very anti-sisterhood.
I don't know.
But then,
this woman is a pawn of her man, and maybe Rihanna's just showing her the light to join this cool girl gang and become renegades.
I mean, are we supposed to believe that she drowns at the end? Because there's that shot of her, like, floating in the water. Or is she just, like, chilling out there?
I don't know, man. There's a lot of violence against that poor white lady who, in my head, I could not help but think was Iggy Azalea. I was like, this is like the rap world's revenge against Iggy Azalea. That just came to me like immediately. Or maybe it's not actually Taylor Swift, although it did remind me so much of that, of the Taylor Swift, the Blank Space video in which Taylor Swift tries to be a bad girl. So...
yeah, or Bad Blood. Like, I think it's actually kind of refreshing that Rihanna is just like, I'm going to straight up murder someone, as opposed to Taylor Swift, who's doing like this passive aggressive, veiled insult to Katy Perry. Right.
Bad Blood did not have a plot. Can we just sidebar on that?
All right. So the ways, so there's a real badass like Thelma and Louise quality. Like, the, did you guys actually, like, I slowed down the video to read the labels on the knives. Did you guys do that? Okay. So, the labels on the knives say deadbeat dad, left the toilet seat up, cheater. Like every weapon is like labeled for a different accountant asshole.
Fucked up my credit.
Exactly.
Well,
exactly.
And her real life accountant, it seems, did in like 2009, 2010. She was left with a mere $2 million after he failed to give her good financial advice, which people described as her being close to bankruptcy.
Right. and then she did get a $10 million settlement from him, probably.
Wow, she and Hillary should start like the Dead Broke Society, right?
Yeah.
So, okay. And then there was, somebody pointed this out, but it was true. Like when you read My Wife in the Backseat of My Foreign Car, you thought it was like, I took your wife and like we're going out and you're staying at home. You didn't realize it was like she meant that literally, like I tied up your wife in the backseat of my car and now I'm gonna kill her.
I mean, that is where it gets tricky, not because, I mean, because we have, unless we're gonna just dismiss this video and start picketing Rihanna, which I don't think any of us are gonna do, we have to kind of choose not to treat it the way we would a movie made by, say, Quentin Tarantino, because it is Rihanna who's a black woman, but also because, like, when she meets the blonde woman in the elevator, and remember, we've all seen all these videos of guys hitting women in elevators recently, she somehow, between her floor and, you know, the ground floor, gets her in a trunk. And you think, actually, she couldn't. She couldn't do that. It's not realistic, which does add a distance before, you know.
Yeah, it's a total satire. This is what drives me nuts about the internet's response to it. Rihanna's making a funny joke that, you know, it's just funny to her. And it's funny to me in some ways. And maybe that makes me a bad person. It's actually like, I can't stand to watch Quentin Tarantino movies.
Right.
I find them too violent. But
sure.
I was kind of like, whatever on this one, because it was so clearly a parody.
Why? Because it had a kind of camp horror to
it? Like- absolutely. And because the sequences weren't extended, there wasn't actually, until the end, there wasn't really blood. You know, I kept checking to make sure the woman was alive. And except for, as Katie pointed out, the scene in the pool, she was alive. I don't know. I just had a totally different response to this than I normally do to like aggressive kind of torture porny kind of movies. And I think it's just the context of it. Like a music video like this is, by definition, doing something different. She's upending our expectations about what we heard. I thought this, when I heard the song on the radio, I thought it was about like a record contract. And she was like, yeah, like pay me, you know, I put out this music, pay me. And she's just.
But it is about that.
It is. But she's, you know, the story that she's decided to tell along with it is this misandrist fairy tale or whatever.
And it does make a difference that she gets naked too. I mean, we not only see the blonde woman's boobs, we also see Rihanna's boobs and we see Rihanna's naked body. That makes a difference to me.
So what do we make of the title of the song, Katie, as the world's leading expert on the preparatory bitch? Does that make it have more impact than, say, Bad Blood? If it were Bad Bitch, would that be different or Bitch...
What if it was the opposite,
bitch, like Bad Blood?
No, you better.
Bitch, we got Bad Blood, or
better have my money, bitch. That's the difference. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, so I do think that this is a sterling example of the prefatory bitch, which is when you start a statement with bitch for rhetorical effect. So, like, bitch, I'm a bus. Bitch, I'm Madonna. Like, bitch, don't kill my vibe.
I love bitch, I'm a bus. That's the best one.
Yeah, because you kind of imagine the bus actually saying it, and you're like, indisputable, bus, you got this, and that, like, or of certainty is like pretty great and funny. But the thing that makes the prefatory bitch pretty powerful is that, as we know, like, bitch is a misogynist slur. It like flourished in 90s black slang. And so it was basically enforcing a power structure where, like, the women, and especially the black women, are on the bottom, and the person saying bitch is probably a more powerful white guy. And so, like, to have Rihanna using the word bitch is kind of transgressive and defiant and swaggering in, like, the peak Rihanna way that we're used to.
And actually, she has a sign pointing to the white guy that says the accountant, a.k.a. bitch, in the middle of the video. When did bitch become gender neutral? Like, when could anybody be a bitch and not a girl, not just a woman is a bitch?
I feel like, well, there's, like, the parallel history of prison bitch, which sort of
That's your next book, is the parallel history of the prison bitch.
Which was, like, you know, a subordinate or emasculated man. So I think there's always been, like, a way to insult guys by calling them bitches. Like, that was definitely around in the 90s, too. Mm-hmm.
Can I ask a grammatical question? In, like, bitch, don't kill my vibe, for instance, I feel like the bitch is a direct address there. And bitch, better have my money, I feel like, is descriptive of him as a, like, there's no comma there. Does that still count as a prefatory bitch?
That is a great question. I don't think
the former copy
actually...
editor in me wants to know.
Yeah, it's not vocative, right? Like, it's not addressing the person, so maybe not.
But it still has the same effect emotionally.
Yeah.
My favorite line, the line that spelled it out for me, Katie, in your piece was, "You need to be a pretty big deal to wield such a fraught word with impunity." So clearly, Rihanna counts. Right. But I don't think I do, for example. Like,
right. Yeah. But it's funny, too, because I feel like, you know, we want to mount a feminist defense of this video and say, like, well, maybe the white woman isn't actually a woman. She's like an emblem of, like, luxury and the power structure. And so it's, like, OK to watch her get manhandled. But at the same time, you sort of get the sense that Rihanna is saying, don't defend my video. Like, it's indefensible. Fuck you. I'm Rihanna. That's the point.
Right. So that's what that last image is about. It's like a horror movie image, and it's a camp image, and it's like, this video is indefensible image, so don't even try.
And it's also Rihanna being flawless. I mean, how can a woman who is just like, she's just dismembered someone, she's covered in blood, she's naked, and she looks amazing. It's ridiculous. Huh. Ridiculous.
Do you think that's what Beyonce had in mind when she, like, was flawless?
She
that's
got up like this.
Do you remember?
I was born like this.
Do you guys remember the video for Telephone, I think, was the Beyonce song?
Yeah, it's the Lady Gaga.
I feel like that shares some DNA with this, but this just went a million times farther in the way that Rihanna... It's the classic Rihanna-Beyonce comparison. Beyonce's was, like, styled and, like, choreographed, and this was just, like, a bloody Tarantino.
I watched that video right after watching this one because it's the first thing I thought of. Now, Beyonce does actually kill someone in that video, so she does go pretty far, but it's like an elegant killing because it involves poison. Mm-hmm. Right. There's no blood on the face. It's like a killing that doesn't mar your makeup.
As they always say in the TV mysteries, poison is a woman's murder weapon.
Exactly.
Well, bitch, poison is a woman's weapon.
Bitch, better drink my poison.
Katie, what do you make of the adjective from times gone by, bitchin'?
What a bitchin' burrito.
Like, what does that mean to us as feminists? Yeah, like when you say, what a bitchin' burrito. Is that good for
when
women,
you
bad
said,
for women?
Because...
I think, well, first of all, there's the accuracy question. Like, okay. Is the burrito actually bitchin'? Because you don't want to, like, oversell a burrito.
But what is bitchin'? Like, bitchin' is positive, right? I love this burrito. This burrito is my bitch in a good way. Right?
Yeah.
Way to kill the word.
This burrito is ride or die.
Yeah. Well, I don't think that it's saying, like, the burrito is my bitch. I think it's saying, like, a bitch has certain qualities which are positive, and because this burrito is bitching, it partakes of those qualities, and therefore, like, that is a totally glowing adjective.
But it's not on the way back, that adjective. I think I just ensured that.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Katie. That was awesome. I will never be able to use the word bitch cleanly again.
Anytime, bitches. Bye.
Okay. Coming up in a moment on the XX Gabfest is going to be our discussion of the 1939 movie, The Women.
Hi, I'm Kristen.
And I'm Liz.
And we're the co-founders of CoolMomPics.com.
And we are also the co-hosts of the new podcast from Panoply called Spawned with Kristen and Liz.
Every week we talk about parenting and parenting culture, hopefully from a common sense perspective. We like to give out tips and tricks and advice.
We talk about media. We talk about kids. We talk about stuff that kids probably shouldn't be in the room to hear. And we talk about our underwear a lot.
I know. We've been getting a lot of emails about that.
So. Why is that?
Well, you know, they are my underwear.
Well, if that doesn't make you want to tune in, check out Spawned with Kristen and Liz.
Yeah, you can go to iTunes.com/Panoply or your favorite podcast app. Hope you'll tune in.
Okay, so now let's jump into our first movie club.
Would you please let me do what I wanted with my own life?
You're very confident, aren't you?
Yes.
Hey, what happened to the hot date you had on for tonight, darling?
Hotter than ever, dear.
I'm having him dine at my place.
I've had 2 years to grow claws, Mother. Jungle Red.
This movie, The Women, was recommended by a couple of our listeners. It's a 1939 movie based on the Clare Booth Loose play. It stars Joan Crawford, Norma Shearer, Rosalind Russell, a lot of the fabulous ladies from the 40s. I guess the way I think of it is it, like, seriously bifurcates the Bechdel test,
yes.
Meaning that there are, like, literally only women. Right? Like, she says, how many women are there? There are only women. It's shot that way in the play. It's shot that way in the movie. In fact, I read somewhere that, like, even the animals were women.
Oh.
Like, they made sure all the dogs were female.
Great.
Therefore, bitches. But literally, all they do is talk about men. So it's like, it, like, totally succeeds and totally fails. It's about some rich bored housewives. It's got tons of gossip, divorce, and a kind of, I would say, faux sense of liberation. So did you guys, I'll start out with this question. Did you feel like it was explicitly designed to make you hate women? Did you feel like, ugh, like, you know? I mean, it's like post the Hollywood Code, so there were no sex jokes. But so I felt like instead they turned, like, the women the butt of all the jokes. This was just like how to an instruction manual on how to hate womankind.
So this did not make me feel like I hated women. Because what it did do was upend your feeling about which women were cool and which weren't, mm-hmm. basically. So there's one character in particular played by, I believe, Rosalind Russell, who looks so much like Deborah Messing. I was just obsessed with that the whole movie. And she starts out, you're like, oh, this is the cool one. Like, she's wearing these super sharp clothes. She's the one who gets all the funny lines. She's perceptive. She's sort of the queen bee of these society ladies in this very cool girl way.
She's Sylvia Fowler.
Sylvia Fowler is her name, yes. And then by the end of the movie, you see that her feminism, so she's the feminist, she's telling everyone don't quit their jobs, and she's the one sort of advocating for the Norma Shearer character to get a divorce, even basically planting items in the gossip press about it. But you kind of don't notice because you're like, yeah, that guy's cheating on her. She should get a divorce. And you're kind of rooting for the Rosalind Russell character to be the heroine. And then all of a sudden, there's a twist at the end, near the end, where she, it turns out, has just befriended the mistress turned wife, and you realize that she's sort of an opportunist and not really a friend to womankind. And so that just sort of upends, you know, is this a feminist movie? Is it not a feminist movie? Who cares? It's just like women who are complicated.
I mean, it has something in common with the Rihanna video, minus the blood and violence and sex and nakedness, because there are these, you know, there's this sense of female friendship as a series of shifting alliances. Like, you could be aligned with one group of women, or you could and you could exclude this one person for various reasons because of her relationship with a man, or because of her, you know, surrounding that idea, or you could be friends with a different group of women. Like, the connections are shifty and suspect.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask a question. So Mrs. Stephen Haynes, the character played by Norma Shearer, in a way that's like just so sympathetic. You just really love her. She's a really nice person. However, I wondered, would we consider her a bad mother today? I mean, she's clearly in this context meant to be a great mom. Like, she's a good sport with her daughter. She rides horses with her daughter. But she also, like, abandons her for good chunks of time. She doesn't tell her daughter that she's going to go to Reno to get a divorce until, like, 5 minutes before she heads out the door of her apartment. Like, would we consider her a terrible mother today?
Oh, my God, that's such... Weirdly, like, I never even noticed that part, because the movie sets you up to think of her as the loving one. Like, she's not just... She's not good in a kind of exactly dowdy, terrible way. Like, she's meant to have a kind of solid core. And that solid core includes the ability to have fun with her daughter. So they're giggling together and they do all these things together. But you're right, when that's not convenient, she's just like, later, I'm going to Reno to live in this, you know, kind of women's home for a while because this isn't convenient. I mean, they did seem to have a lot of fun. Like, if you think of the way in later periods, like once you get into the 60s, these kinds of rich board housewives, suburban housewives, become like the Stepford wives, you know? There's a lot of emotional resonance. They completely lose their agency, or they become depressed. You know, in the feminine mystique, then in later years, they're sort of soulless and in existential despair. These guys are kind of terrible, but not in existential despair.
They felt very modern to me in a lot of ways. One of them works, first of all. And then just the spa scene was hilarious. Yes. Because I'm betraying my ignorance, but I didn't realize that how little beauty treatments have progressed in the last, you know, better part of a century. They were all getting facials and manicures that look just like the facials and manicures you get now. They were even, they're like slimming exercises.
Yes.
I swear it could have been like a Pure Barre class. It was these tiny little motions that are all the rage now in exercise classes. It just was very funny to me.
I love the exercises where you basically lie in bed and just like move your legs a little bit. Like, that would be an exercise group that I could really get into. And I love that they all kind of interrupted each other's sessions and just like, you know, the gossiping continued.
I find that depressing. Like, that spent all their days like at the manicurist. I was like, wow, things have just not changed very much. It's like facial, manicure, exercise. Oh, and they even talked about starch and gluten. That was crazy. Like, didn't we think that was a new thing? She actually mentions the word gluten in this movie.
Yeah, super wild. It just really... Women's magazines have been recycling, like, yeah. All the press has been recycling things for a long time.
Yeah, we usually probably use the throwaway 30 years, but it's actually like 80 years that they've been recycling the same tropes. Now, what about the class element of this movie? Like, it was very the rich women versus the working class girls. Like, it's, you know, Joan Crawford plays the girl at the perfume counter who steals Mr. Stephen Haynes. She's crazy looking, Joan Crawford. I always forget that, how just angular she is, you know, how sort of sharp and angular. And it's like the idea is that these working class girls could upend your comfortable life at any moment. Like, they use the manicurist to spread the gossip. They use the perfume shop girl to steal the husbands. Like, they're just dangerous, these working class girls. I wasn't sure what to make of that.
Well, and one of them says, the class feeling you run into these days, you know, they were aware that you know, the underclasses were rising up to them. I mean, I think that is appropriate because for those women, that is how the world seems. I mean, we're seeing life from their point of view. That just seems like a narrator issue.
There was one working class girl. I think she was a showgirl. Miriam Ahrens is her name, I believe. She was having an affair with one of the richer women's husbands, but she got to be sort of on the side of the angels in the end. Like, she turned out to be having an affair with like the bad woman's husband. So within the moral logical of this movie, it was okay. And she was a friend to the Norma Shearer character. So it was okay. There was just an interesting moral calculation going on there.
There was an issue too, I think, where When you're a rich woman living your New York lifestyle and you only see other women essentially as your servants, they're not going to be your friends. But when you go to Reno and you're, you know, at the ranch waiting for your divorce to come through, there is more of a sisterhood. So I think if Miriam Ahrens had run into, you know, Mrs. Stephen Haynes and her friends in New York, they wouldn't have been friends. But once you're in Reno and the typical roles and you're just women together, you know, going through this experience, that felt like that was an opportunity for these class lines to be a little bit broken down.
Yeah. Like, what did you think of their, what was the idea we were supposed to pick up about divorce? Divorce was liberation or it wasn't liberation? What was divorce supposed to represent?
It seemed like it did not. I mean, I get that to me was the hardest thing to parse, because clearly it is not good to have your husband cheat on you. That is never going to be cool. And yet there was this view that Mrs. Stephen Haynes had made a mistake by being invested in her pride, that maybe she should have given her husband another chance, that she shouldn't have gone through with the divorce. And in fact, at the end, they do get back together. And he still cheated. He still, you know, it's just because Crystal left him for another man doesn't mean that he, you know, is any more worthy of his wife's love. So to me, that felt like, you know, the message seemed to be that pride is a mistake. Don't be too prideful, girls. It'll just get in the way of your marriages.
Maybe Claire Booth Luce was Dan Savage before Dan Savage was around, you know, that monogamy is difficult. And that if you love someone, you shouldn't let old-fashioned institutions like marriage sort of hem you in.
Well, she was divorced and married a couple of times, and this very much reflects her life, which is that she had a kind of precarious relationship with marriage, like with Henry Luce, for example. Like, marriage is what gave her her social standing. She married way up, like way, way up. On the other hand, she couldn't really stick with her marriages, and she was depressive and had a complicated emotional life, but her famous marriages allowed her to lead the life that she did and sort of brought her into society. So she depended on them, but she also chafed against them, much like the women in the movie.
There is a very funny novel that I may have recommended on here before by this woman, Dawn Powell, who is a contemporary of Claire Booth Luce, called, I think, A Time to Be Born, in which she satirizes Claire Booth Luce as basically one of these grasping sort of underclass women who, like, hooks a rich man and uses him to, you know, rise to all sorts of heights. And the novel sort of implies that Claire Booth Luce was not a good writer, which was pretty clearly she was. But if you're sort of interested in her, it's a really fun read.
It's interesting, too, because Norma Shearer also made a very good marriage. She was married to Irving Thalberg, the movie producer.
Oh, Irving Thalberg.
Oh, you know,
don't say.
Huge movie producer, you know, who was, I don't know, you know, bigger than Weinstein in his time.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, he was the Hollywood producer, and, cool. And she married him.
You know, there was a line in the movie that seemed to summarize this. It is Mrs. Stephen Haynes who said this, Norma Shearer character. She says to her mother, who's encouraging her to stay quiet and say nothing about the affair, she says, "Women were chattel. They did as men told them. But today it's different. Stephen and I are equals. We took each other of our own free will." So I found that really depressing, because it's like women always think that they've made it. I mean, this is like a commentary on my own book, The End of Men, right? It's like we always think that this is it. Like, we finally reached equality and liberation, where it's perfectly clear to us seeing this movie, lo, these years later, that they're nothing like equal. They're still completely dependent on these men for their social standing. You know, they live in a kind of hermetically sealed bubble of kind of female gossip, and, you know, they're in trouble if the men leave them or have affairs. So It was depressing to hear that she, who was our heroine, thought that they had reached a point of equality.
But you know what? They got better lines written for them than actresses now get. That was the depressing thing to me, to realize that just how bad movies featuring female characters have gotten. The lines were just so clever. The patter was so fast and sharp. And it was just extremely pleasurable to watch.
Yeah, very close to the line that you just read, Hannah, when they were talking about Stephen's affair, someone, I think Norma Shearer, said, "Women can change their hair, hire a new maid. A man longs to see himself reflected in another woman's eyes." Oh, my God. I mean, it's bullshit, but it's deep bullshit.
Right. So this, to tie this back to our Rihanna topic, there is a point where Crystal Allen, as she realizes that she's been outdone by the rich ladies at the end of the movie, has her Rihanna moment. She looks in and she says, "There's a name for you ladies, but it isn't used outside of a kennel."
There were some great like oldie terms. I had to look up several things, and it was clear as I was Googling that lots of other people had been watching the women and had Googled, because there were, like, I was looking up this term Beazle that they use kind of a lot, which has not survived. It's not come down through the years. And I guess it was a kind of 1939 version of bitch, although according to the dictionary, it's more just kind of chick or, you know, dame.
How do you spell Beazle?
Well, I looked it up as B-E-A-Z-E-L and got answers like that. But there were, you know, I typically watch television with the subtitles on or with the closed captions on. But for me, this was a necessity in this movie because they talk very fast. They say some, just let's listen to a couple of other weird things. Like there was one where she said, one of the best things about divorce is being able to spread out in bed like a swastika, which was just like, what? And it was 1939. And then the daughter said, the only good thing about divorce, you get to sleep with your mother, which is also like, oof. I know what you're saying, girl, but that just sounds a bit weird.
God, Beazle sounds like a word like Snoop Dogg would make up, you know? Like if he was around in 1939. This is my Beazle.
I think he might actually say Beazle.
I know, like, that just sounds right.
Now that I'm thinking about it.
Or Bazeezle, maybe it would be. Have any of you seen the modern version of the movie?
No, I wanted to, but I ran out of time. It's supposed to be pretty terrible, right? It's like J-Lo and...
She's made some good movies, come on.
One.
All right. Well, if any of our listeners have seen the modern version of the movie, can you please post on our Facebook page and tell us if it's terrible, if it has some good parts, and how it updates the 1939 original? So let's move on to our recommendations. June, why don't you go first?
I don't know if you guys have been watching the show Unreal on Lifetime, but if you haven't, you totally should. It is amazing. It's a sort of a satire on reality dating shows like The Bachelor, The Bachelorette, but it's behind the scenes.
I so want to see that.
It's really good.
Yeah, me too.
They had a great discussion of it on the Culture Gabfest. Willa Paskin had an amazing review in Slate. Emily Nussbaum also wrote a great review in the New Yorker. But it is such a good show. I don't watch The Bachelor, Bachelorette, and those shows, but I still love this sort of satire on them. It's created by Marty Noxon and Sarah Gertrude Shapiro, who worked for more seasons than she wanted to on The Bachelor. Shiri Appleby, who plays the hero of, well, anti-hero, I guess, of the show, is doing amazing work playing at least 10 years younger than her actual age. It's just really a great sort of dramatic, melodramatic show. I'm absolutely loving it.
So I want to recommend a book called You Are You, which is a photography book by Lindsay Morris, M-O-R-R-I-S. You can look up her website, find a lot of the pictures there. It's a series of photographs about a summer camp for children who are transgender. I know some of these kids from when I was reporting my story. The book was sent to me by my photographer friend, Jonah Frank, and it is such a beautiful book, and it's so cool, and they're like walking through the fields or doing a fashion show, and she just got unprecedented access to these kids, and it's just cool. It's a really great book. We sit and look through it all the time in my family. Noreen.
I want to recommend Magic Mike XXL, which I saw last night and sent you guys an email the minute I got out of the theater. It's very different from the first Magic Mike. It's just hilarious and not trying to be serious. It is just very funny. It's basically a buddy comedy setup. It's a group of guys sort of on a journey to get in touch with their like themselves, but it just turns into this very raunchy look at what female desire is circa 2015. And there's I don't want to spoil it, but at the end there are like a series of dances from each of the strippers that sort of touch on a different way a woman might want a man. And it's so sociologically interesting, but also just camp and fun, and you will just like have a hilarious time at the theater. I cannot recommend it highly enough. And Channing Tatum is just so fun to watch on screen. He's an amazing dancer. And just go see it.
Oh my God, I so can't wait. I'm going to see it on Thursday. You know, someone on my Twitter feed recommended that, like, if Aziz Ansari could write a book with a sociologist, that maybe me and Channing Tatum could get together and write some kind of, like, end of men book. And I was like, oh my God, yes, that's a lovely idea. I love that idea. And I, like, fainted. I fainted in my own house. I love that movie. The first movie I've seen more times than I'm willing to admit. Anyway. All right. Well, thanks to our producer, Ann Hepperman, our managing producer, Joel Meyer, Andy Bowers, the executive producer of Slate Podcasts, and our intern, Jesse Chasen-Tabor. The XX Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/Panoply. To find out more about the show, go to our show page, slate.com/XX. You guys have been great listeners logging onto our Facebook page, starting discussions. We love it. We love it. Do more of it. You can talk about whatever we talked about today, recommend new topics, facebook.com/XXGabFest. Our email is always XXGabFest@slate.com if you want to ask more private questions or reach us that way. And of course, subscribe to us on iTunes so more people can find out about the show and listen. For Noreen and June, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will talk to you in a couple of weeks.